Hello, everyone. Welcome to Watching Silent Films. I have to get the name right. Watching Silent Films podcast. My name is Yifeng, and with me are my co-hosts, Lily and Bob. Hello.
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 Greetings, greetings. And today, we're going to kind of go back a little bit in before one of the first episodes we have, where we're kind of just the first couple episodes, we call it the dawn of cinema, like the beginning of cinema. And we were looking at this list put together by, I'm going to get the guy's name wrong. I should have researched it. But he put together this list that is kind of going through every year from 1888 and beyond and highlighting sort of the most influential films for that year. There's more than one, but he's kind of basically J.J. Duvaldi. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing that, but that's how I'm reading it. J.J. Duvaldi's site, zapfanman.com. I can put a link in the show notes. But the part we're going to go through today is part one. The first few podcasts we did was on part two from 1898 to 1907. Part of the reason was I really wanted to cover a great train robbery, the Edwin Porter film. And also the Georges Méliès movie, A Trip to the Moon. So that was like why I wanted to get into that, because I think some of those two are often at the start of film history books. They often proclaim that as the start of narrative film. And in some ways, it's still kind of true, because even a lot of stuff we're going to talk about today is very highly experimental. It's really hard to have any narrative that we understand today with our modern eyes, right? Mm-hmm. So the 10 films, part one, again, the link will be in the show notes, and this is from 1888 through 1897. And before we get there, and by the way, that's kind of the format our show. Well, every week we'll pick whether a series of films or a feature will focus on just watching and talk about it. So that's kind of what we do here at Watching Silent Films. And you can find more of our stuff at watchingsilentfilmsplural.wordpress.com. And you can email us, same thing, watchingsilentfilmsplural@gmail.com, if you have any questions or thoughts or comments. And before we get moving on, I just want to see if folks at Lily and Bob, if you had time to watch anything in the classic realm. Typically, I describe that as before Star Wars.
Well, before Star Wars, yes, but whether it's a classic or not, I watched The Shakiest Gun in the West.
What's that about? We started to talk about it the other day.
That was probably 1960s, early 1970s maybe, a film with Don Knotts.
Ooh, and, Don Knotts.
If you've watched The Andy Griffith Show in Mayberry, he plays, you know, Barney Fife. And he's an inept deputy who's always very skittish and nervous. Well, he basically brought that same persona into a film where he's a gunslinger in the West, sort of, but not really.
So is it a comedy?
Oh, it's ridiculous. It's absurd comedy, yes.
I see.
But I like it. I hadn't seen it since I was a kid. I thought it was hysterical when I was a kid. When I watched it again, I went, few chuckles, but no, all in all, pretty silly.
Is it technically a Western or not really?
It's definitely a Western. It's definitely a Western. I mean, it's, you know, he's...
So it's like a shock schlock Western, right?
Yeah. It's goofier than Mel Brooks, but it's not as funny.
Well, yeah, Westerns have... I mean, if you consider The Great Train Robbery as a Western, you could... some people make a case for that. You could call that a Western too, in 1903, right? So
absolutely.
Trip to the Moon, which is science fiction or fantasy,
right?
And The Great Train Robbery, a Western. The first few films, narrative films, are genre films. If you think about it, Lily, do you know what I mean when I say genre films?
Well, a genre is a type of film that we like to go see because it makes us feel wonderful. And that explained nothing.
Well, that's okay. The reason I asked is because it's kind of You know what I'm talking about, Bob, right, when I say that?
Well, yes, I kind of understand what you're talking about. It depends.
Yeah, it's a kind of a...
I mean, a genre like film noir is a style of film more than a genre. I mean, you're talking about a genre of film, I would mean like spaghetti westerns would be a genre.
Yeah, so if you, later on, you guys Google genre films, it's kind of a derogatory term towards film nerds who just focuses on horror, science fiction, maybe Western is proper too.
Oh.
It's basically these genres that is not the mainstream type that people watch. So, for example, which is why this year was a strange year for Oscars, because usually the Oscars don't pick genre films. And genre films are like, like I said, science fiction, horror, the things that isn't typically mainstream. Like, what I think mainstream today, at the time that we're recording 2020, is like, I don't know, 1917 would be a mainstream movie, for example. Or
right. Whereas The Artist, you would consider that a genre film?
Typically, I think the term is really for film nerds. So if you're like a film nerd and you're like, you really, really get into certain genres, it's a derogatory term towards those type of people.
No kidding.
So it's
that's
like,
funny. I never would assume that.
Yeah, so like that's what the term has been for a while now. So like,
that's funny.
Even for filmmakers, like, oh, you're doing a genre pick, right? It's like, oh, you're doing a
like
lesser.
You're not supposed to do that. Huh?
Yeah, or like Roger Corman's the perfect example. Like, if you like Roger Corman movies, like, so like Ed Wood, have you heard of that, Lily?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I've heard of Ed Wood.
Yeah, so that's Roger Corman right there, and so he's. Like, he's made all these movies, and... Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's a different person. So, but it's a similar... I mean, that's Ed Wood, obviously, so... But in terms of the style of movie, right? It's like this, like, off the... Or, like, most recently called The Room. You heard of the thing called The Room where... I forgot the guy's name, but he's, like...
Oh, Tommy Wiseau.
There you go. So he's, like, making this movie. He's like, oh, this is amazing. And he... You're like, is something off with this guy? Like, is he serious with the quality movie he's making, right?
Oh, yeah.
Or a Rocky Horror movie. Those are all genre movies. They're not mainstay movies. They're movies that are like
offbeat.
A niche population film nerds that like and enjoy and love.
I see.
So if you make a movie
Python.
Like that. Yeah, if you like that's not mainstay stuff. So that's what the genre pick is. So why did I... start saying that. Oh, so like westerns is kind of nowadays kind of like a genre movie in the sense that nobody really watches westerns anymore. It didn't used to be a genre pick, right?
There've been a number of westerns in the past few years that have been popular,
but
like,
you know what I mean, like a long time ago westerns were the premier mainstream
right. in the 50s they were every weekend there was a new western out of the theater. Yeah,
well, I would say from the early dawn of cinema, 1910s, 20s, 30s, and beyond, all the way, like you said, to the 50s. But like that movie that you just cited in the 60s, that's when it started to... The Westerns have gone through many revisions, right? There's so many revisionist Westerns, like The Wild Bunch and so on. So every few decades, there's a new Western that erases the old Western and does new things. But anyways, that's a whole nother conversation down the trail.
Okay.
But the point is, it is, it still kind of focuses on the classic realm of things. So that's cool that you watched that. It's a genre pick, I call it.
Okay. I gotcha.
Now you know.
I like a lot of genre films.
Yes. There you go. There you go.
So I'm a nerd. I admit it.
That's okay. And Lily?
Nothing in the classical realm, of course. I recently did just see... the film Clemency. It's with Alfre Woodard. Woodford?
Mm-hmm.
Woodard. So, yeah, it was very good. It's very... makes you think. And it's very... It's a hard watch, but, it does open your eyes about things. And the week before that, I had seen... I believe it was 8 films from the animation Show of Shows. In Worcester, I met with a man who is in charge of the cinema, like Cinema Worcester, and they try to host films that don't normally get seen.
You mean like genre pictures?
I suppose they are genre pictures.
Yeah.
But, yeah, very unique choices that aren't mainstream.
Exactly.
So, yeah,
that's pretty much the definition of that. So. Now you know. Next time you see him, you should ask him what that means. He might explain it to you.
So you would put the artist in there because, I mean, it's a modern-day silent film.
But I think it won the Oscars. So that,
yes.
that becomes like, Oscar. Well, what do you do
but
with
But that's
that,
one right? of those, that's the oddity. The oddity is that it seems like a genre of film that they liked.
Well, that's why I said, like, Parasite was unusual. Like, the fact that Parasite won the Oscars was a very unusual year. Normally, a movie like that doesn't win the Oscars. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty cool. Yeah. Anyways.
Maybe the Academy is having an itch for...
Maybe. We sidetracked long enough, so let's bring it back.
Bring it on down. Bring it back to tonight's feature.
Yeah, so within these 10-year scope, 1888 all the way to 1897, it basically lists out most influential films of that particular year. And I'm going to group some of them together because they're basically by the same people and the same studios when we get to it. So let's just go down the list, and I'll read a quick description of what it is and kind of go from there. That sound like a plan?
Okay.
Sounds good.
All right. So the first one is 1888. It is Roundhay Garden Scene by Louis Le Prince from France. And the description for this is four figures walk in circles within a garden recorded on October 14th. 1888, and is considered the oldest surviving, although incomplete, film in existence. The Prince has been heralded as the father of cinematography, despite his mysterious disappearance in 1890, and Edison's subsequent claim as the sole inventor of cinematography.
Mm. Oh, Edison.
Yeah. What do you guys think about this one?
Did Edison do the recording?
No, this is Louis...
Oh, okay, that's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah.
What did I think of it? I thought it was... interesting only as an example of authentic attire of the time.
Yeah, it's like a history. I was talking to Lily earlier before we start recording, saying that these films, just to put it in context, these early films essentially were technology demos.
Exactly.
Like they're not, like that's why I started the first podcast with the narrative, a few of them that have narrative. So it's a little bit more interesting. But these, almost all these, aren't really narrative. There's no, like, story behind them. They're just like, oh, look, you know, we can do motion pictures now. And one of the examples I often use, at least in the first few podcasts, was like a modern-day equivalency, technology-wise, is virtual reality, like VR.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know how familiar you are with VR, but it's like, I think our attitudes of VR nowadays is like, yeah, it's kind of like a shtick, maybe, and it's kind of an interesting thing, but it's not like anything that's going to change my life right now. You know what I mean?
It will become mainstream.
But that's what I'm saying is, like, I think that's was the people back then when this motion picture technology started to, you know, both the still photography as well as motion picture started to become sort of mainstream.
They lack vision.
Yeah, so like when they're starting to play with all this technology, a lot of them, in fact, we'll get to a few of those on this list, actually, that basically will abandon films and say, this is just a novelty. It'll be gone in a few years. And that's what you hear a lot, actually, in the media about virtual reality, right? People treat that as like glasses. It's like 3D, right? So glasses, I don't want that, you know? And then say that's just something that's temporary. That's not going to be a mainstay. So, anyway,
what's funny is when 3D movies came out, there was one of those demo movies at the theater. And it was called Coming At Ya.
Yeah.
And my cousin and I went and saw it together. And yeah, the glasses were annoying. And I thought, man, who would want to watch a movie without wearing glasses? You know. And we were teenagers at the time, and this movie was at the Showcase Revere Theater. And we sat next to each other, and we were watching this film, and it was appropriately named because Coming At You, because all kinds of things were coming at you on the screen.
I have that, by the way. It's on Blu-ray 3D.
You have that film?
That's why I'm trying to invite you to come over and see it.
Hysterical.
Anyway.
Anyway, there's one part where an Indian has a bow, pulls the bow back in profile, and then turns it 90 degrees and faces at the audience and lets the arrow go, and it flies at your face. And my cousin Mike and I both dodged the arrow physically and cracked our heads together because we both dodged in opposite directions. But it's hysterical. I mean, it was great to watch this movie, but it was only a series of 3D examples.
Exactly. And so I think the audiences back then, there was no audiences. These are just inventors, builders, creators. Mm-hmm. And like Louis LaPrence is one of those people that did that. And he was an inventor of this stuff. And so he actually created all these single lenses, and he actually built a 16 lens thing. You know how like some of these mobile phones we have has like 3 lenses? I think Samsung's coming out with a 6 lens phone. Like everybody's competing with one another.
I know. I think those are so funny. I'm just all like, right. Whoa, man.
So the reason for that is because when they shoot a picture, like one lens can kind of focus in on the background to make it super clear. And one of the other lens can do the foreground and kind of blend using software algorithm to blend both and make both super sharp and clear. Like, that's not the only thing they do, but like that's a common thing that they do, right? Now, this guy, Louis LaPrence, right, in the early to late 1880s, did that. He built a 16-lens camera. He didn't do it the way that we're doing now with software, of course. There's no software back then. But the fact that he built a 16-lens and each of the 16 lens recorded the same exact footage, right? So that's not the thing. But I think that if he kept at it, he probably would have arrived at a certain invention point where he could have experimented more and it would have become something interesting. I don't know. But he, again, like many of these early inventors, it's sad. They created something amazing. And almost all these guys on this list, a huge number of them are Renaissance people. This is this is in some ways pre-industrialization age and just post-Enlightenment age in some ways. And so many of these people are just like, they're jack of all trades and master of all, like they know so many things and they can do so many things. They weren't just focused on a specialized trade or skill, right? Mm-hmm. And so, especially in France, it seems to be film, cinematography, camera, and like France seems to be epicenter for like all these things, building these things. And he's one of those guys. In fact, there was a documentary called The First Film in 2015, all about his story, about how he created all these things. So I guess for people who are wishing to know more about it, there's a documentary in 2015 called The First Film about his life story. Anyways, long story short, that's why he shot these experimental things. And apparently his life was just a strange occurrence because he got on a train in 1890. The train left, but by the time the train arrived at the other station, like his brother saw him off, right? He had a brother. He was like, all right, see you later. And then at the other end, who was receiving him, like they didn't find him, his wife and kids. Like, where is he? Like, and supposedly, like, there was a photo in the 1980s or something found that had a body off of the river in the same year in 1890 that was similar to him. So he may have jumped the river either. There's so many conspiracy theories. Like,
oh, wow.
Did Edison put a hit on him, kill him?
Wow.
Or did he commit suicide because, you know, he was in debt or whatever? Like, there's so many conspiracy theories, but like, that's the reason they made a documentary about this guy. So like, okay, the film itself is only a few seconds and it loops, right? But, and we don't really get a narrative sense out of this film, but the fact that you can research the history of this person and what his contribution was, I think that's more the point of the highlight. Does that make sense? Like, his contribution to film was this singular thing about capturing this just moving picture, one of the early surviving things. That's the significance of his. Even though he didn't go on to do other things. But his life was a strange thing, too. But as a side note. any other comments before we move on to the next one?
I'm shaking my head no.
The next one is hopefully not too long of one, but I'm going to take the next one. Monkey Shine, Dixon Greeting, Blacksmith Scene, Dixon Experimental Sound Film. Because they're all the same by the same person, essentially. So it's William Dixon, William Kennedy Dixon in New Jersey. He did the one for 1889, 1891, 1893, 1894. And I'm going to read descriptions for all these. The monkey shine one is a blurred figure waves his arms for the camera. 1888 to 1890 were very experimental years with multiple inventors trying to create a viable moving camera device. William K. L. Dixon was Thomas Edison's photographer and became the principal designer of their kinetoscope. The next one is the 1891 Dixon greeting. Dixon moving his hat. It was shown with a prototype kinetoscope at the Menlo Laboratory for a convention for the National Federation of Women's Clubs later that year. The blacksmith scene. A blacksmith works a piece of hot metal with two assistants. Each shared a bottle of something to drink between hammering sessions. Shot in Edison's Black Maria studio circa April 1893. This film has many firsts associated with it, but is primarily a demonstration of Edison's kinetoscope viewing device ready to be reproduced commercially.
Are you skipping over the fly and poor Pete?
I'm grouping the William Dixon pictures together because it's the same person in the same studios. And so I'm doing all of them at the same time because they all shared the same stories, essentially. They all came out of the same company and group of people creating these. In fact, the same studio called the Black Maria. Dixon plays a violin into a recording. This is the 1894 Dixon experimental sound film. Dixon plays a violin into a recording horn while two men dance to the music. In final seconds, a fourth man briefly crosses from left to right behind the horn. Edison Dixon added a cylinder phonograph to their kinetoscope, calling it kinetophone. Due to technical limitations over the next 30 years, sound innovation was set to the side in favor of advancing projection and other filmmaking techniques. So I think that's the last one. Oh no, there's another one. I'm putting these out of order. Some reading, blacksmith. No, I think that's it. I had a duplicate on my list here. So, so the story behind this is that first, we can talk about the William Hise cameraman. He essentially was an employee, just like William Dixon, of Edison Company, Edison Labs. And they kind of the work for hire. So not much is known about William Hise, except that he was one of the cameramen to help shoot that first experiment. There has only been, notice it says Monkey Shines number one, there's like two or three. Three is lost. I have seen two. Two is very similar to the first one. It's very blurry. It's on their Wikipedia. It's very experimental, like I got, you guys know. And but William Dixon is more the well-known person as opposed to the other guy who shot the other one, the first one, the Monkey Shines. So those are basically just tests, like we're just saying. So. William Dixon is a Scottish inventor. He moved to New Jersey he was looking for a job when he was in Scotland. He was like, "Hey, can you give me a job?" And he didn't. And then he moved, and then he got a job in Edison Laboratory because they don't pay for moves. I'm sure. But anyways, I guess they worked together and they created this thing called the kinetoscope, which is essentially the camera that we know today, patented by Edison in 1888 in October and unveiled in 1893 with multiple prototypes. William Dixon eventually left Edison Company and formed his own American Mutoscope and Biograph Company around 1895 before returning to the UK in 1897. He and Thomas Edison are credited with the technology where you look through a peephole for the camera or the projection. So if you're recording the film and you play back the film, it's still you have to look through the peephole. But actually, that's where the term peephole comes from anyways. So they invented that whole technology where you guys know the whole story, peephole historically. Red light district.
Oh yeah.
A lot of porn stuff.
Oh yeah.
So that's where this whole technology all came out of here. Even in 1897, they created all this stuff. So, yeah. So all these shorts that I just described from the 1889, 1891, 1893, 1894, all of them were shot, except the first one, were shot in a physical studio called Black Maria. It was built in 1893. It's long gone, but they have replicas now. It's in West Orange, New Jersey. And it's a prototype. It's like supposedly the first quote-unquote studio that produced commercial pictures to be exhibited for money commercially. And it was from 1894 to 1901 they started to exhibit the film shot from within the Black Maria. And the reason why it's called Black Maria is because it reminds people of those older police vans. In all those police vans, there's a paddy wagon. In the back, it's all black. And so it's all crowded, and hence Black Maria. And so they shot over 1,200 plus short films and features during that time. And they have a replica built in over the years, but they did it a few times. The final time, it supposedly exists today, was built in 1954, and it's in West Orange, where the laboratory is. The Edison National Historic Site now, they declared it. So I found a weird history thing where they filmed, for some reason, I didn't look further than this, but some circus, some act was needed to execute an elephant, and they filmed, Edison's company here filmed the whole thing of like torturing this poor elephant and killing it and electrocuting it to death.
Yes. Oh my God.
Yeah. It's funny, such a weird out of the things that you would film. But again, these were different times.
this is a very odd blip.
Yeah. You're going to kill an elephant. I want to film that.
But it wasn't just like the one thing. They were like torturing it. I don't know why you want to torture it. I don't know. That's a whole nother thing wrong. Altogether. Yeah. It was just really strange.
Desensitize the military guys, you know?
I don't know what's going on back then. But anyways, that's the Black Maria. And that's the reason for highlighting this in all these years, because the Black Maria is so influential, at least as a point of history. Not that that studio produced anything, I think, interesting, like in terms of narrative film, but historically it created a lot of work. Like a lot of artisans from all over the country would actually fly or travel, not fly, but travel to this location to do their act, to be filmed. And hence, it's sort of like a little bit like Elon Musk kind of going to like all these Hollywood or, you know, pop culture parties, like trying to befriend all these people and taking pictures of them. Same thing with Thomas Edison. When these artisans would come from all over the country, some of them were already popular in their own right. They would actually contribute towards Thomas Edison's popularity because, you know, he had the only one, the Black Maria studio, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And so some of them wanted to be captured by this moving picture technology. Mm. So it's quite interesting. So in short, that's Black Maria. And in short, that's kind of the William Dixon story with him. I get the sense that, I don't know how much you guys know about Thomas Edison, but I get the sense that I think William Dixon basically invented this working under Edison, but because he was the employee of Edison, and Edison being the employer, still had to put his name in there because he's the one that paid the salary.
Mm-hmm.
Even though
he funded the project.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So even though he didn't physically, invent this stuff, it's like accredited to him. And he was very big on getting credit, right?
Yeah. Well, a lot of people are. I mean, if you pay a crew of 100 people to accomplish a goal and they do it, of course you're the one who says, yeah, I did it.
Right. And so that's part of Thomas Edison's story, is that, you know, he grew up in Ohio, Michigan area, in the West somewhere, and kind of moved around. Long story short, he's kind of an inventor person, but he was also a smart businessman. Like when he was 10 or 12 or 14, he did something like, I forgot what the details were, but he wrote his own local paper and sold it for money. Like, he was he had a huge entrepreneurial spirit, even at a very young age. So he was a very curious child. He would tinker a lot in the basement and sort of experiment and invent things. And so he did have inventing skills, and it was really into that. But like I said, he was a smart businessman, right? He liked to patent everything and take credit for everything. And so, and the point I'm trying to make is that William Dixon was kind of a Renaissance man, and so was Thomas Edison. Like, all these guys who invented all these incredible technology for film were like Renaissance people. They weren't just doing one thing, they were doing multiple things. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's like Edison, right? So, you know, he born in 1847, died in 1931. He's known for the phonograph, which is like the early days prior to vinyl, essentially, or the gramophone, like the thing that you play music back on, right? The motion camera that we know, light bulb. And he did a lot of the stuff in the Menlo Park Labs, which was in New Jersey, West Orange, I think. And one of his first experiments was using some sort of X-ray. Like, he's trying to figure out how to use X-ray to take, you know, like the X-ray we know of today. And he one of the experiments, he exposed a fellow person who was doing an experiment with him, Clarence Daly, with a poisonous dose of radiation, who later died. So through this experiment, he kind of inadvertently killed somebody. He did some work on infrared technology, obviously the phone, kinescope is the motion picture, and he did a lot of patents, right? And so his patent story is the thing that's going to affect the rest of the film industry quite significantly later on when we get through some of the other movies. In 1908, he started a motion picture patents company. So he had a trust, and then he had a conglomerate of 9 movie studios. Basically, it's like, anything motion picture related, the technology, I will try to patent and own. And that put a crimp on everybody's style if you were like a creative person. You know, like if you were, say, if you're D.W. Griffith, you're like, I want to shoot stuff my own. I want to create my own stuff. I don't want to be submitted to your stuff. And that's part of the reason why so many filmmakers didn't partake with the East Coast stuff, because actually film started in the East Coast, right? Mm-hmm. New Jersey. It didn't start in the West Coast. But this whole thing about patents and lawyers and copyright and money just, you know, left a bitter taste in so many inventors / filmmakers' mouth that they moved to West, to California, where also the sunlight was readily available, too. Because in Black Maria, they actually had to have a easily removable ceiling to let the sunlight in to do the day shoots. So, you know, light was very... But as you know, in the winter, it's hard to shoot, you know, around the area. And so both the weather and also just all of these sort of...
building designed as a convertible.
Yeah, so all this stuff just of Edison trying to basically copyright and take on the film industry as a whole. Like, he wants to grab a big part of that money, right? That power struggle pushed a lot of filmmakers west, and that's how Hollywood, as we know it today, came to be established. Because you have these, you know, kind of riffraffs.
Kind of how America was established.
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
Escape the tyranny, right?
Yeah, and you know, here he is, kind of like a tyranny for copyright patents and business and stuff that, like, all these, you know, creatives that didn't want to be pinned under, and that's kind of the relationship between Hollywood and this East Coast studio, I guess, which is interesting because it started here, it didn't start over there. And he was a lifelong friend of Henry Ford, and who was in the similar area, obviously for automotive industry and the process, manufacturing process, mining tech process, battery, chemicals, phenol. He created a lot of phenol and stuff like that. So anyways, that's his life in a very quick, short summary. So much more has written about it that we don't have to get into his life. But I just want to highlight some of the stuff he's known for, but also what his contribution and what his relationship to film is. Because some of that piece, like I just said, the patent company really pushed a lot of filmmakers into the West Coast. So that's kind of his positive and negative, I guess, contribution towards the film industry. I found something interesting about him, too, that in a media publication, they're interviewing with Thomas Edison, and they were like, so do you have any, like, special inventions or something that, you know, you're working on, nobody has worked on that? And he basically was like, yeah, I'm working on a spirit phone where you can call mediums or spirits. So, like, they published it as if he was real. Wow. Remember, it's, you know, around the turn of the century. And
Edison proving that people will believe anything they're told, right?
Exactly. And so, like, the reason I brought this up is because media then, I know there's so much stuff to talk about media today, but media back then, there's so much more of playfulness between not just business people, but especially Hollywood creatives. When they talk to the, not just like the tabloids, but like any media, New York Times, very respectable journalistic sort of integrity type, you know, outlets and media, they'll actually just make up stuff like on the fly. Like, down, if you fast forward down, like Douglas Fairbanks, any a number of all these huge, you know, megastars, and, you know, oh, who's the guy in Gone with the Wind? Was the Clark Gable, right? Or all these directors, like who did It's a Wonderful Life? What's his name? Frank Capra, for example. Yeah. So, like, these huge stars, huge directors, they often talk to the media, any media, and just tell stories. Because they're just playing with them, right? And then publish them. And in fact, even in their autobiographies, they make up stuff. Like, it just wouldn't be. They just treat the whole thing as not serious. Yeah. Right?
Mark Twain had a famous saying, I'm going to paraphrase it, but it basically went, there are many, many great stories told about me, some of which are true.
So, I bring that up because, like, you know, it's so when a lot of biographers nowadays kind of leaf through old documents, they always write it with that perspective in mind. They do their fact checking.
Yeah.
So the truth is always somewhere in between, not like what they say it is, right?
Because truth is out there.
Yeah. And so, like, modern times, there's this call for, like, oh, the truth, journalistic integrity, and for, you know, for people to be more authentic, and if you're not, you kind of get pinned on. Well, media back then, so many people, even like Edison and or artisans, like, they often will just treat it like willy-nilly, like they don't care, you know.
Yep.
Anyways, so this is a side note. It's quite interesting to how the media to see how the media interacts with the early film inventors, but also the artisans later on that will populate Hollywood. Side note too, while we're here, is you can use IMDb search function to figure out how many films were created or produced by country. And I don't know where somebody was asking me a question somewhere from some thread somewhere, and basically they're like, the U.S. just, like, factually had more works than any of the other countries, and it's true. So somebody helped me. Did some research, and from 1895 to 1930, USA has had 65,000 titles, or more than that, credit to it. Like, wow. Movies, even if it's like 2 or 3 minute shorts, right? Doesn't matter. Like the thing we were just watching. But individual, separate, unique titles. UK had 17,000, France had 16,000, Italy had 10,000. So you can see, like, America dwarfs, right? Any of the nearest countries in terms of the filmmaking output, impact too, you know, in terms of volume, right? The sheer volume of experiments in the early days. Any other thoughts before we move on? I know there's a lot of stuff, but
no.
Nope.
That was kind of the thing about these experimental shorts. They're kind of like, I kind of equate it today's, like, have you heard of the CES? Consumer Electronics Show, or any of the trade shows nowadays that will demonstrate technology. It's essentially what these things are. You know, they're kind of, hey, here's the camera, and I'm demonstrating things, experimenting things.
Yep.
Let's move on to The Fly.
The Fly.
Not the movie The Fly with Jeff Goldblum.
Which I thought was fantastic.
But
For all of the 6 seconds it is.
Yes, all of these are just a few seconds. Repeat it. High frame rate film of a house fly taking flight. There is not much information about this particular video.
I'm not being sarcastic. I was literally blown away when I saw it.
Mary was an innovative doctor who created many photographic devices, usually focusing on her body.
I could not believe that I was seeing something from 1890. Just couldn't believe it. I was like,
yep.
That is absolutely astounding.
So the person's name is Etienne Jules Maury. I think I'm pronouncing it correctly, maybe. 1890. It's called The Fly. The clip was just very zoomed in, kind of thing about just how the regular fly takes flight. And so this guy's, like I've been saying all along, is another Renaissance person. Basically, he created what's called a high frame rate film, where you shoot the film at a high rate, but when you play back at like a normal 20, 30 seconds, frames per second, it appears as if things are moving very slowly, right? It's like, you know, bullet time, as it were, that we know of today, like The Matrix for this fly. So it's basically, so he invented that. And the reason he invented that is because he is a man of science. He really wants to know a lot about like cardiology, aviation, and how and cinema, laboratory photography. He has a lot of interests, but one of the big interests he has is like biological studies. And part of the reason for creating these photographic technology is for him to capture nature, like the fly that you see here, so that he can actually study it for biological purposes, right? So it's interesting that all of his interests, like one thing feeds into another. Like his interest in like dissecting and figuring out like the biology of stuff was like, I gotta capture it in real time, like in real life. So he created, because it wasn't available, he created a technology to capture it. I mean, that's astonishing, right?
Yep.
And he also created kind of like a Fitbit type to count your heartbeat too.
When you see slow motion in films today, you think, oh, it's a special effect. You know, and it really was a special effect in what he was doing as well, but he wanted, it was just so that you could see the motion.
Right.
But I didn't know that was capable. I didn't know it was even he was even capable of doing such a thing in 1890.
But film, if you think about it, is one big special effect. That the fact that you can,
yes,
you know, have a picture that was still, but then move it at, you know, X number of frames a second, that by itself is a special effect.
24 frames per second.
Well, back then, that wasn't really established until sound came along.
No kidding?
Yeah, okay. So because sound needs a specific rate so that the sound doesn't go like that, right? So if you speed it up, right, like the audio will be like chipmunks.
Yep.
Or if you slow it down, it'd be like, you know, slow as molasses. So when they started to feed sound right next to the film's sprockets, that's where the audio is going to be. That's why they had to lock it down at a certain frames per second. But prior to sound, like this guy or any of these guys, usually silent films would range from 11 frames a second to all the way through 40 or beyond frames a second. Because it was experimental, right? Like VR today, like I was saying. In VR, is there any rules? No. You could have augmented, you know, reality. You could have virtual reality. You could do anything you want. Everybody's that's experimenting. Funny. Everybody's doing things differently, whether that's people funny. Like it or not. And that's what they were doing back then. Like this guy. He was just, I want to do stuff in my science. No, I'm going to create these technologies to do it. So
I really wonder when he did that recording of The Fly and he played it. I mean, you're saying he literally played it at a different rate of flash?
Well, that's how you do slow motion without a computer, right? So how you do slow motion is you would shoot something at a very high frame rate.
And then you'd have to double and triple the frames.
No. So when you're recording the film, right? If you have a camera and you're recording, right? let's say you recorded the film at, I don't know, 60 frames a second.
I understand. You're talking about compression, right?
No, I'm talking about analog film, right? Like a camera film.
Right. And
so when you're capturing this film at like 60 frames per second, for example, and then when you play it back at, you know, 11 frames or 15 frames a second, it slows the whole thing down. That's what produces the effect
of right. But to change the amount of frames per second changes the rate at which your flash is going off. It flashes per frame.
Right. So if you capture the footage or whatever you're shooting in the camera at a higher frame per second and you play it back at a slower frame per second, that's how you create the effect of slow motion.
Right. It's just interesting to me because it's not like a record player where right. you could have slowed down or sped up with your fingers the play, you know?
Well, these early cameras, yeah, no, they're manual. They're hand cranked.
It's got a shutter and the shutter moves with the crank. Oh, okay.
These are all like...
It's very interesting.
These are all initial products. These are not the things that you
yeah,
know of even.
I don't know the technology. That's yeah, why I was
these,
amazed.
These are all like because, early days, yeah.
Right. I was amazed that he was able to slow it down.
Yeah. You know? And so, that's how you practically do it. You shoot it at higher frames per second and you slow it down. So, wow. I love it.
I have to look into that.
Yeah. So, any other questions about this one before we move on? It's interesting because if you trace the lineage of this to modern day, have you guys heard of Gemini Man most recently? I think that was a few months ago.
Yes, with Will Smith.
Yeah, and it was shot by Ang Lee. You heard of that right. title, Lily?
Ang Lee?
I've heard of the title. I just haven't seen it.
So he captured the film at 120 frames per second, digitally, of course.
No kidding.
In 3D. And so, like, there's only, like, 4 or 5 theaters in America, I think, that was able to show it at that. But wow. That's the best way to see it, is that you shoot it 120 frames a second, and you play it back 120 frames a second per eye for 3D.
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
Anyways.
Okay, I'm blown away.
So that's, like... I'm tracing the lineage, right, from 1890 all the way to now in 2020. You know, more than 100 something years, 130, 40 years later. Wow. Another thing that's interesting is like at the Oscars, if you guys watch the Oscars, on the red carpet, there's a guy shooting high frames per second and slowing it down. If you've seen blips about that and clips about that. But there's a camera out there that shoots digitally, of course, 1,000 frames a second. And they would have these celebrities pose, doing their poses, whatever. And it would slow it down. And it's like the fly clip that you saw. It's a super silky smooth. That's how you practically do it, even digitally. Today, without any fussing with...
1,000 frames per second.
Yeah, that's crazy.
That's pretty amazing.
And yeah, they use these cameras to show the effect of how bullets would do on whatever properties.
Like right.
Shooting through a brick, a jello, etc.
Wow.
So, like, if this guy lived, Etienne Jules Marie today, he would be the guy who would be using that all the time to study. What would it happen if I did this and if recorded 1,000 frames a second? And I bet he would come up with some breakthroughs biologically because it's amazing. Anyways, so that's this guy. Let's keep moving here. 1892 is an animation
short. Poor Pete.
Yeah, poor Pete. A description is here is two lovers meet. A third man, Pierrot, comes to sing to the woman but is scared off by her lover. While Dixon and Lumiere works dominate this first decade of film, Renault's innovation animations and projection devices were ahead of the pack with exhibitions up to 15 minutes long.
I thought it was wonderful.
Yeah, and again in France, not a surprise. So it's Charles Emile Renault, again Renaissance man, inventor.
My note said it was animated ballet.
Yes. He is known for film perforations, and he created. They all call it scope for some reason because I guess it makes the word make sense, but proxenoscope. That's what they call it. Pantomenes, Lunienius, something. It predates the Lumiere Brothers demo in 1895. He worked on it from 1844 through 1918, I think. It actually reminds me a lot of the Python skits. I don't know if you guys remember Monty Python.
Yeah, it has the same type of coloring.
Yes. So, which is funny because I bet you the Pythons were paying homage to this guy, right? Because this came in at 1892, right? And the Pythons were in the 60s and beyond. But I'm specifically talking about the TV series, right? So the Pythons weren't just movies. They're
the Flying Circus.
The Flying Circus was four seasons of amazing comedy. And Terry Gilliam, he did a ton of animation for that in this very similar style.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, funny nowadays, it's just like memes, right?
Paper-mâché.
Yeah, exactly. What do you guys think of this one?
Which one? Poor Pete?
The Poor Pete animation.
Oh, I thought it was fantastic. I loved it.
Yelly?
Sorry, I zoned out. no, I really liked it because it's just showcasing one of the earliest forms of animation, which to me is fascinating. I grew up watching cartoons, so I'm instantly blown away that something was made in 1892. And since we were talking about it, you know, thinking that they have in the YouTube video, there's music to it, but I'm sure it's not the original.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? I only realized it as we're talking about it. But I wonder if they must have probably added the sound effects if him. Because I believe there's whistling in it.
Yeah, there's some things in it. There.
Yeah, I don't think much is known about it. Based on my research, maybe other people have more to add to it. But it's one of those things where it's like it's an amazing demo, again, of what this medium is capable of and what the storytelling possibilities exist or can exist. And I think these are just the artisans, inventors who are just flexing their muscles of what it could be. He is known to be one of the first, if not the first, to do the film perforations. By that I mean those film sprockets, the holes in the films that later other people like Edison and others would claim that they patented and said that they did it. But this is the guy that supposedly may have started it or contributed towards it greatly somehow. It's very hazy. It's like all these history. It's hard to say that who's first, right? Who got there first? Nobody really truly knows, you know? And like all these guys were built on top of work that has been done since the, you know, 1830s when still photography came out. You know, ever since that time, many people, inventors, have been trying to make a motion picture out of the still photography, you know? So it's like parallel development, and actually also worldwide too. There's a lot of work done in France that's also done by Edison in New Jersey. It's just, and they don't always talk to each other. It's amazing they're creating things almost at the same time, right?
Let's see.
Well, we can keep moving if you guys don't have.
Was the workers leaving the factory?
That's Lumiere Brothers.
Okay.
That's the next one. So that's 1895, the workers leaving the Lumiere factory. Workers cross the gate of the Lumiere plant and are followed by a carriage drawn by two horses. 1895 was the year cinema was truly born. This was the first film on the program of the Lumiere Brothers, Auguste and Louis, premiere public exhibition, December 28th. Their patented cinematography, both recorded and projected 70 meters of celluloid actuaries, mini documentaries approximately 35 to 60 seconds long, hand cranked, and they took hold of the world's imagination. As with many films of this era, the mere actualities were reshot over the years. The best research concludes that this two-horse version was shot on May 26th.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
I thought it was very interesting. Another great example of the styles of the time, and I thought it was really interesting to see the attitudes of the people leaving work. They all seemed fairly happy and in a big hurry to go home.
Yeah. Or they know that the camera is right there.
Maybe that's what's making them smile, yeah.
But they don't know what it is yet.
Did you notice that as the first guy on a bicycle comes out, he almost runs over the dog?
Oh, yeah. I don't think they care about dogs back then. Yeah, so these guys, again, just like all the other previous people, you know, Renaissance people, they did had a lot of interest, one of which is sun photography. They did a lot of, they had some manufacturing background. And that's why they're able to kind of film this this scene here. They actually exited the film industry by 1905. They're the guys, of all people, Lumiere Brothers would say, this is just a novelty. This is going to be over in a few years. So they went on to focus on color photography, called the Lumiere Autochrome, which, you know, developed and worked on color photography from there on until it was mass-produced in the 1950s. So it's so interesting. They could have made something, but they didn't. They just like, this is going to be amateur. I'm out of here.
I didn't realize they exited.
Yeah.
That is really interesting.
Yeah, so it's like, it's sort of like I said, I keep going back to this, but it's the closest thing I can think of, like virtual reality today. If I was a virtual reality producer, I would labor at it, come over a few gimmicky things, and be like, "Yeah, it's going to be a gimmick. It's going to be done in a few years." And, you know, if I get out now, in 5 years later, it's going to be the biggest thing since, you know, film, right? Yeah. Right? So, it's one of those things, right?
Yeah, I wonder what they must have thought after, you know, once all these movies started happening, you know, years later.
They thought, oops.
Yeah, oops. Yeah.
I am sure somebody wrote what I called a big fat book on it. Or maybe other people call it big fat, but I probably took this from somebody else. The next one is the 1896 The Cabbage Fairy by Alice Guy Boucher. Now, Lily, you'll notice that we took this on already in the part two, right? If you remember. This one's called The Cabbage Fairy by Alice Guy Boucher from France. The director dances and picks babies out of a cabbage patch. Alice Guy, later known as Guy Boucher in America due to a film partnership with her husband, Herbert Boucher, wrote, produced, and directed over 700 films and has only recently been recognized as one of the four major cinema innovators alongside the Lumières, Edison's crew, and Méliès. Correction. This is the only existing segment of the 1900 remake of the 1896 film. So, even back then, they were reshooting and remaking their own stuff. So the 1896 version is lost. It does not exist anymore. And this is one of those fairy tale stories that all French children supposedly know, where that's where children comes from these cabbages. They're grown, sort of like the stork story, right? You know, the babies and stork and all that
stuff. That's where we get Cabbage Patch Kids, huh?
It's something like that. So this is arguably the world's first narrative film and first directed by a woman. And Algy reportedly said that she had to remake the film twice, at least twice, dating from 1900 and 1902. And anyways, there's a lot of discrepancies between all different versions, but essentially that's kind of the idea.
That was kind of creepy, frankly.
Yeah. It's a genre pick.
And the way she put these kids down on the ground, it was almost like the last half a foot she dropped them. I mean, I was like, what are you doing?
Well, if you research it, this is one of those fairy tales. And if you know, like, Brothers Grimm, it's all very similar to the.
Yeah, but the kids were real. And the way she put them down, it's like she let them go when they were, like, barely on the ground.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, not my type of fairy tale, I'll say that much.
Yeah, well, we're going to get into a lot of her stuff later on when we start going through her entire filmography. So, so the final one, I think, is called, in 1897, The Corbett Fitzsimmons Fight by Enoch Rector from America. The boxing one, the boxing clip.
Mm.
And,
honestly, boring.
Yeah, so
that's so funny. I'm gonna
read the description here. A single vantage view of all 14 rounds of a live boxing match.
I was like, why couldn't they have made this one of the 2-minute things?
But they did, though. If you look at the link, it says here, I'll read it. While only 20 minutes of footage exists out of the 90 minutes, right? Is unprecedented in that time, by the way. The longest film around that time frame was probably like 50 minutes an hour, but he did a 90 plus minute. And the Library of Congress posted a best of 3-minute clip, so you probably should watch that instead.
Exactly.
Now, what's interesting about this guy is that, like the Renaissance idea, is that he wasn't a film anything. He was a boxing promoter.
Mm.
So he was like that, who's that boxing promoter I know of? Don something.
Don King?
Yeah, same idea. Imagine Don King shooting something. That's this guy. So, you know Don King, Lily?
Nope.
So,
Don King is smart enough to know that you should just do the highlights.
Yeah. So Don King is like a big boxing promoter for like back when who was the big heavyweights?
Rocky Balboa.
No, you know the
Marciano.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the
Ali.
That and also Mike Tyson. That's what it is. So Frazier, like
Mike Tyson.
Yeah, a lot of big boxing legends is promoted by this guy, that Don King. So he's a huge boxing promoter.
Yeah.
So Enoch Rector, this guy, is like him, basically, but in 1897. And he shot this because he wanted to promote. He's a promoter, that is a true promoter. And what's unique about this is the fact that it's long. It's a long documentary, 90 minutes. But also, it's the first one of the first uses of a huge film format. Traditional film is 35 mil. This one's 63. It's almost like a CinemaScope, huge widescreen IMAX format type idea, you know, like Lawrence Arabia, shot in 70 millimeter, and it was 63 millimeter, and it was in widescreen, like 1.75, which is basically our HDTV widescreen aspect ratio. Most films back then was 1.33, very square, but this one's like basically in widescreen. It didn't show it in the clip that was shown here, but the actual original film negative was like that. So that's why this was a unique contribution, I think, was why it was highlighted. You know what I mean?
Yep. That would make sense.
Yeah. Cool. All right, that's really it. And you know, I kind of echo some of your sentiments. A lot of these weren't meant as narrative features. These are just experimental, and that's why it's not really story driven. That's why it can be.
I don't want to go too far on a tangent, but did you already cover Moscow in the Snow?
Is that?
I loved it. I loved on Moscow the list? In the Snow.
Let's see.
I think it's. I guess it's not because obviously you were considering the boxing match at the end. But
yeah, was there? Another
if you
one
go
after?
On, it's further down. Moscow in the Snow, and then White Fawn's. White
oh,
Fawn's
you're,
devotion.
You're using the other list. There's two lists. yes.
And then there's Dante's Inferno.
Yeah. Okay, so
I watched all of this.
Oh, good. That's good. We can probably circle
back. Cameraman's Revenge, which I laughed hysterically.
Yeah. So.
We'll do that another time.
So you have to click into part one, and it brings you all the clips that you need to watch.
Okay.
That's the difference. Sorry, you didn't clarify.
That's all right.
But anyways, so there, because I think this guy kept adding to this list because the original premise is 10 years, 10 films. But then if you look at it, he added like 3 films for 1897, you know?
I see.
So that's no longer one film per year.
I went right down the list. I went all the way into 3/4 into Intolerance. And
yeah, that's all right. We'll cover some of those things later. In fact, I think next week we will cover part 3. Now, for part 3, make sure you click open that link, and that'll be the films we do.
Okay.
So once you open the link itself, that's the actual list of one movie per year, right? So So, sound like a plan?
Sounds like a plan. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to skip some of those, right? We're going to skip Intolerance because it's so long. And there's a lot to talk about that one. And something else.
I think Dante's Inferno?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, those two.
It's an hour and a half, and that's kind of hard to watch in some ways.
Yes, yes. Very complicated. It's just going to take up a lot of time to talk about it, I think.
It's very cerebral, yeah.
Yes, yes. All right, well, anything else on the first 10 years, the part one from 1888 to...
Enjoyable. All in all, quite enjoyable.
Yeah,
except for the boxing match.
Well, I think if you are viewing with a lot of modern, I think it can be all just boring because they're just demonstrations. They don't have narrative features for them.
You've got to be in the right state of mind. You've got to be looking at it as a historical document about silent film and development.
Yeah, which is why I stated kind of in the...
and that's why you're always talking about context. If you don't get it, you're not going to care.
Right.
But also, like, you almost have to study / read more about this era of time rather than actually even seeing it. And seeing it is good, but to find out more of the backgrounds about it. And, like, if you know the backgrounds, you'll figure out the significance of why they're the way they are in the early days.
Right. If you like the history of film.
Exactly. So, that's the thing about, like, watching silent films is, like, are we focused on narrative film or are we, like, okay to watch non-narrative film? Because clearly today it's all basically non-narrative film. You know what I mean?
So
I think typically we enjoy the narrative films because there is a story, there is a beginning, middle, end, and we kind of track with the directors and the filmmakers and figure out how they do it and what they do, you know, good, bad, and different. It's just if it's not narrative, then it becomes like, what do you do with that, right? You treat it just like film history. And that's kind of all you can do with it, right? So.
All right, you're saying non-narrative. I'm thinking when you say non-narrative, I'm thinking like fiction, like modern sci-fi, like modern movies.
Well, I mean...
You mean narrative, meaning a storyline from beginning to end.
Yeah, so like...
Okay.
So when you were watching Intolerance, right? You know there's a beginning, middle, and there will be an end, right? There's
right.
a story for it, like that Inferno clip. But if you look at some of the stuff we looked at, these are just demonstrations of what the capture technology,
right. tech demo, there's no narrative.
There is no narrative, right? So it's like, in lieu of that, the only
you
thing
create we, your own meaning behind it.
Well, we have to write the narrative of the history, and that's the only way you can kind of study it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There's this article, I'll link it in the show notes as well, but I'll also send it to you guys, talking about that the clip of The Fly, and it just really embellishes on it in a very I don't always agree way, but it's this it's like he's basically the article is saying so he's saying okay so Harvard concluding that The Fly is important purely in the spirit of academic investigation does not take away from the director's achievement in the sphere of artistic representation. The film, as seen in the context of its time, offers a glimpse on how the technical cinematographic possibilities are capable of creating emotional experiences for the viewer that are unique to the film. Nature documentaries have become an intrinsic part of our connection with the natural world. The sophistication achieved in modern times in the works narrated by naturalists such as David Attenborough have shown that we are still possessed by a spirit of awe at the sight of phenomena that are imperceptible to the human eye. And Mary's film is arguably the first to generate the particular response in the history of art. So it goes on, but like, maybe. But I think he's trying to make the point of like, today we're watching like Planet Earth, right? Or David Attenborough, whatever those BBC specials are, and we're like, wow, this is amazing. It's like shot in 4K and HDR and super special, amazing technology. You know, you can capture all this stuff in nature, right? And we're like awe at this creation itself, right? All of it, right? But anyways, all nature, you know? And he's kind of making a connection between like that clip of the fly to that we're experiencing now.
Right.
But like that takes a lot to connect from that to planet Earth, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I know. That's how I view it, anyways. Because even the modern stuff, they tend to tell a story, right?
I personally don't see it as a large leap, but
yeah. What I'm saying is, like, if you look at those planet Earth type docs from BBC, or they edit it in a way that it tells a story somehow. There's some sort of a story in there still, you know. There's some sort of narrative.
Well, there's a narrator.
No, but there is a narrative. They shaped the documentary to tell you a story.
Yeah,
and
they
the fly
around
didn't
the
really
story
do that still,
portray.
Right? And that's the point. What I'm trying to make is, you know, there's a thing about narrative films. It has a structure to it that we kind of appreciate, like a poem almost. There's a structure to it. But then there's this, like, experimental stuff. What do you do with that? You can only kind of read the context and figure out what the historic and significance of those things. And that's harder to appreciate, right? So, in my opinion. So,
for most people.
Yeah. So, I think later on there will be another movie I think we'll get into called The Man with a Moving Camera or something. Oh, I gotta search this up now before I forget. Yeah. It's a 1929 movie. I think it's a silent one, but it's an experimental movie, Soviet silent documentary, 1929. And that's exactly the thing, is that the whole thing is highly experimental. I mean, you know?
Wow.
Anyways, we'll get to that eventually. All right, folks. All right. Anything else before we wrap up?
No, that's great.
Yeah, I can't think of anything else to talk about.
Okie doke. Thank you very much, Lily. Thank you, Bob, again, very much for your patience. And some of this stuff, I think, it can be grating if it's not like a narrative film, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Hate to admit it, but it's true.
Yeah. So I think there'll be some of that next week. Actually, we might try to fit Dante in there. We'll talk about it, but we'll fit at least one narrative in there to balance out the narrative nature of experimental stuff, and then that might balance it out a little bit. Okay, so that wraps up and concludes today's podcast, and thanks again for all the listeners who are just enjoying and hopefully enjoying and listening to this. And you can find more of our stuff on watchingsilentfilms.wordpress.com. again, that's watchingsilentfilms, films plural, .wordpress.com. And likewise, you can email us if you have any questions, thoughts, or comments, watchingsilentfilmsplural@gmail.com. and you can find our podcast anywhere the podcast platforms are available, like Apple's iTunes, or they call it podcast nowadays, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available to download and get. And that's it for today. So thanks again, everyone, and we'll talk to you again in the next couple weeks. Thank you. Talk to you later. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you.